Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
My mission is simple, to make you money. I'm here to level the playing field for all investors. There's always a bull market somewhere, and I promise to help you find it. Mad Money starts now.
Hey, I'm Cramer. Welcome to Mad Money. Welcome to Cramerica. Other people make friends. I'm just trying to make you a little money. My job is not just to entertain, but to teach you. So call me at 1-800-743-CBC or tweet me at Jim Cramer. Is it finally time to dust off the March playbook? Remember, this market got crushed in February as we realized the Fed wasn't done tightening. Then we had some banks collapse in early March, and we stopped worrying about the Fed because we figured the economy had to be weakening. That led to a wholesale shift into tech and out of finance. That turned into a launching pad for a multi-month run led by the mega cap techs, especially the Magnificent Seven. So could a similar situation be coming together now after weeks upon weeks of pain?
The house of pain.
That may be what we saw today. Dow advancing 127 points, S&P gaining 0.81%, and the Nasdaq jumping 1.35%. It was a total shakeoff of the endless selling, and it really didn't start happening until later in the afternoon. While it's hard to believe that history could repeat itself, especially within 8 months, I got to say the setup seems remarkably similar, even if the starting point's very different. Yep, today we had a bit of a replay from March, where newfound worries of a recession from demand destruction overwhelmed those who were fretting about an inflationary spiral of growth that seemed impervious to all the Fed's rate hikes. We just don't know if this is merely a one-day respite, though, or maybe the start of something bigger. Hey, come on, after the charnel house we've been through, a few hours of higher prices looms larger than maybe it should. It's been down so long it looked up to me today. To give you some context here, let's rewind the tape to the spring. In March, we had the collapse of a few highly visible banks, which set off a wave of fear that all of the regional banks might be going down like dominoes. That fear caused a collapse in Treasury yields, a run toward the most solvent companies, and an abandonment of any company that needed to borrow money to make the numbers, as a recession appeared imminent. As the mini bank crisis dragged on, Treasury yields plummeted out of fear, and it seemed like the Fed might finally actually be done tightening. At the very least, they paused, and that was when the Magnificent Seven were born. And by the way, they were born out of desperation, the desperation of finding companies that had a lot of cash, didn't need to borrow. They were flush. Now, we all know what's happened since then. The economy didn't stall. In fact, it accelerated. The Fed started a new round of rate hikes, and it made clear that interest rates would stay, and then we use this phrase over and over again, higher for longer. In response, a very quick but narrow bull market turned into a wide and horrifying bear market masked by tech as rates climbed ever higher, almost piggybacking off the rally in oil. The most visible sign that the economy had become a runaway train, with stocks looking like a bunch of school buses stalled on the bond market tracks. That is until today. See, today, oil, which had been hanging on by its fingernails after a brutal reversal 2 days ago that caused it to lose the $90 level, suddenly just got annihilated, falling more than five percent to 84 bucks and change. This thing was 94 a couple days ago. It was a breathtaking decline brought on not by new supply from the Saudis or the Russians or even the Permian Basin, but by a collapse in demand. Specifically, seasonal demand, the lowest in 25 years, because of high prices at the pump. That's right, gasoline, it got too expensive. And that collapse caused long-term Treasury yields to plummet. Remember, it seems like there's less inflation. Very, very refreshing after watching them go up in a straight line since April, isn't it? Makes perfect sense, too. When long rates were soaring, we were constantly told the bond market was dancing to the tune of oil, because oil is widely seen as a barometer of economic strength. Today, we realize it's possible that the turbocharged oil rally may have been nothing more than a charade, a sham even, something brought on by a short squeeze that ended when oil couldn't take out 95, let alone $100. Sellers, actual sellers came into the market, and the refiners no longer seem to be begging for more oil because gasoline demand's been drying up at these high prices. It happened overnight. I mean, literally overnight. Now, there are a host of important indicators that are showing a much more mixed picture right now in the economy. We still have a robust job growth and business formation, according to John Gibson the other night that we had on the CEO of Paychex, which is the largest payroll processor for small and medium-sized businesses that are doing so well. The manufacturing economy is certainly humming. Maybe that's that infrastructure money. There are parts of the country where companies still can't find enough people to hire. We know there's still inflation flaring in many places. Plus, between the Fed and the Treasury, way too many bonds are being sold, which sends those Treasury yields higher. Remember, it is still a market. There's too much supply. But for a brief moment today, we saw the division between the flush and the naked, and the money rushed to the companies that were flush while running away from those that need to borrow. That's just like the March bottom. So was today a real repeat of March, replete with cascading bank stocks and the commodity stocks being clubbed into submission? I know you don't want to hear me say this, but we can't be sure. We have an auto strike that threatens to get out of control, with both sides hardening and billions being lost in this country because of the disruptions. Autos are a meaningful part of the GDP. They can't bring the economy down by themselves, but a strike can throw a lot of people out of work. We got housing numbers today that show the fewest mortgage applications since 1996. Hey, no kidding. Mortgage rates are almost at 8%. Of course, that's going to matter. They're 3 and change about a year and a half ago. Housing's been a horse, but maybe not such a swift horse anymore. Are these symptoms of legitimate slowdown that would make the spike in long-term Treasury yields a one-time chance to lock in a much better rate than you've gotten if you want to invest since 2006? Or is it all fool's gold? Truthfully, again, you don't want to hear this, but I don't know. Isn't it better just to own that? I don't know. But here's the good news. We don't have to wait that long to find out. We don't have to wait. On Friday morning at 8:30, we get the September non-farm payroll report. That's the single most important set of government statistics out there. And that's not just my opinion. Everybody knows it, including the Fed. Now, I have examined the long-term impact of every single report that comes out from the government, and the only one with true staying power to influence both stock and bond prices is indeed the non-farm payrolls report. If it shows more layoffs than expected and slower wage growth, it'll be hard to justify the relentless rally in interest rates. They'll seem like overdone, and the Fed's more likely to stay its hand. So what do we do? Well, because this stock market is as oversold as it was in March, and you know I care about that oscillator, and that's where we got to, when we had the fabled tech-led rebound, I certainly can't count on selling. You might be dumping your stocks in the beginning, but could be a better behaved bond market with earnings reports that will most likely be pretty good. In particular, like in March, I think tech will shine, especially the semiconductor stocks that aren't connected to cell phones. Hey, somebody downgraded Apple today and the stock went up. What does that tell you? We've been buying some tech for my charitable trust, which you can follow along by joining the CNBC Investing Club. Purchased some yesterday. At the same time, the economic weakness could change the Fed's approach is going to hurt plenty of companies. Here's the ones you got to think about: retailers, banks, and housing. In March, it was really just the banks. Now there are far more sectors that are, let's say, on the ropes. Last night, I left here having watched videos of the usual billionaire suspects telling us on air the regular litany of negatives about the coming collapse of our great nation on the altar of the national debt. I watched hedge fund managers, many of whom are probably likely short bonds, telling us to get out of bonds now because it's too late, because bond prices are going to get crushed as interest rates soar because of hyperinflation. I saw moguls blast anyone with even anything remotely positive to say, calling them out as charlatans, as naive bulls. I did not hear one person, certainly not one billionaire, say it was time to buy anything. Now, uniform negativity doesn't always mean we're about the bottom. Neither does this market's extremely oversold position, nor the decline in oil. But let me put it this way. We certainly have plenty of tinder for a rally. There are some Kingsfords lying around and maybe even a Duraflame or two. You get a weak payroll number on Friday, then I think we can get a narrow repeat of the rebound we saw in March. Bottom line, maybe all that needs to happen is for the frantic bond sellers to slow the pace of their sales. They don't even have to stop. They just have to be less desperate. Once that happens, we can finally focus on the myriad stocks that have been crushed for weeks now, many of which don't deserve it. No need to jump the gun, though. We'll find out soon enough. Zach in Texas. Zach!
Jimmy, how's it going, man?
Not bad, Zach. How about you?
Oh, it's a Monday. Having a case of the Mondays, but we'll get through
it. It's kind of, I think it's like Wednesday. That's all right. That's all right.
I might be wrong.
Let me check. I got a bunch of Apple things here. Oh, Apple, sell, right? I mean, isn't that what they say? Go ahead.
That's what it is. Look,
yeah, Apple's only down 30. Time to dump it, right? I mean, we got to get out of that one. What's happening?
Look, man, I've been trying to pull the trigger for years, but here's what I'm on. In the next 5 years, where do you see Target stock going?
5 years. Wow. Guy wants a five-year Target call. Okay, I think the Target is a very good company, but I only really like it in the retail business. I like TJX. I like Costco. Okay, they're good. And I like the Amazon, and I'm willing to throw in Walmart because I'm a forgiving judge of retail. All right. But whoa! Nice shot! Hey, take that! Now, it might be too early to tell, but if the bond market can stabilize from here, we may finally be able to focus on some of the stocks that have gotten hammered over the past few months. On Mad Money Tonight, Warren Running hosted an investor day earlier today highlighting how many shoes my wife has bought in the closet. No, a host of long-term growth targets. And with the stock dropping the announcement, I'm running through the latest with the company's top brass. Then breaking up is hard to do unless you're Danaher. I'm taking a closer look at the story after the company spun off its Environmental Applied Solutions division. Hey, you got some interesting stocks here. And this year's been volatile year for the beer stocks. But could a stock like Molson Coors buck the trend? I'm checking in with the company's CEO. So far, I like what I see or taste. So stay with Cramer.
Don't miss a second of Mad Money. Follow at Jim Cramer on Twitter. Have a question? Tweet Cramer. Hashtag Mad Tweets. Send Jim an email to madmoney@cnbc.com or give us a call at 1-800-743-CNBC. Miss something? Head to madmoney.cnbc.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Fact: running a business is not getting easier on your wallet. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. Also a fact: smart businesses are reducing costs and headaches by graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. See how you'll profit with NetSuite, and then you can think of all the ways you could be spending the money you save. Company retreat in Malibu, anyone? By popular demand, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com to start saving.
What in the world happened to the stock of On Holding today? This popular Swiss sneaker maker, best known for its running shoes, is a longtime Cramer fave. But after a magnificent run from its lows last October, the stock's been clobbered along with everything else for the past couple of months. It's fallen from $37 at its August highs down to $25 now, including a nearly 4% decline today, even as the rest of the market rebounded. See, On Holding had a chance to reset the narrative at its Investor Day event today, but Wall Street didn't seem to like what they had to say. Didn't matter if these guys rolled out some very ambitious long-term targets. They say they can double their full-year net sales by 2026. That's pretty solid. Market only seemed to care that management didn't raise their full-year forecast for this year. I think that's a very short-sighted reason to sell an extremely high-quality company. But do not take it from me. Earlier today, we had a chance to catch up with On Holding's two co-CEOs, Martin Hoffman and Mark Maurer. Take a look. Gentlemen, welcome back to Mad Money.
Super happy to be back.
So glad to be here.
All right, Martin, let me start with you. You had this analyst day, and I think it was very encouraging. But you put out some incredible targets, doubling net sales between 2023 and 2026, exceeding 60% gross profit margin. How can you do that?
Yeah, we had a great day here. It was so good to finally be able to bring our investors here to really experience what our culture is all about. It was a day was full of innovation, product, but also the numbers that you mentioned. So we continue to dream on. We want to double our sales in the next 3 years, reaching 3.55 billion net sales by the end of 26. And We want to even accelerate on our profitability targets. So our aspiration is to reach 18% plus adjusted EBITDA target at the end of 26. We have a lot of momentum in the business. We talked a lot about what are the growth opportunities that we have. And I think everyone left super excited.
Well, I've got to tell you, I know I was, and I've been a big supporter of yours. I felt at 20, look, 35 comes down to 25. It seems cheap, but I got to have people understand, Mark, when you talk about elevate, expand, establish, what do you mean?
Yeah, look, elevate, we're speaking about what we've already been doing in the past. So we're speaking about the opportunity that we still have in running. We speak about the opportunity that we still have in trail. We speak about the opportunity that we have in geographies like the US or the UK. And then the next vector is, you know, things where we just started. So, for example, we feel, you know, we're just getting started in markets like China. We feel we still have a huge, you know, huge room for growth in own retail. So this will be a key growth vector going forward. And then there's, you know, elements that we're just starting. And this is the third element. And here I want to point out training. So we've observed more and more people wearing on, especially the CloudX in the gyms of this world. And we feel we need to give them more apparel, more footwear. And we very much feel that entering training as a category will allow us to significantly grow going forward.
Yeah, I thought one of the most telling pages in your deck, Mark, was the actually lack of awareness that people in the U.S. have in other countries, that the runway seems so big given the fact that there are many people who have never even heard of you.
Yeah, I mean, in Switzerland, we have 47% brand awareness, right, which means we still have 53% left to 100%. In the U.S., we're not even close to where Switzerland is, so we're investing a lot in brand build. We're investing a lot in athletes. We want to create bigger moments, and one of those was around the U.S. Open, you know, where Ben Shelton made it to the semifinals, and it really shows basically that investing in these big brand build moments works. For example, our search on tennis apparel and On as a tennis brand was up by 1,000% in the U.S. through the U.S. Open. So these are some of the big bets that will continue to enter.
All right, so Martin, it is confusing to me. I was in a stock picking contest and I said, I want On. And there was a wag, someone who was critical of me, who said, are you not aware about the inventory problem? Four of the analysts asked about inventory. There's too much inventory. I came back and said, I think I want good inventory, not bad inventory. But they just chided me and said, Jim, you don't know how to read the balance sheet. Could you, as the CFO, explain to the people who don't believe in On that your inventory situation is not a detriment to your progress?
Yes. So our inventory situation is that our inventory levels are a bit elevated because of the disruptions that we had in the aftermath of COVID, but it is all fresh and good inventory, which we expect to sell at full price, which will drive the growth over the next quarters. So we feel we have work to do in getting that down, but we don't have a risk to our profitability.
Okay, very good. That's important because a lot of people continue to tell me they're short the stock or whatever. I say good inventory, I want it. Bad inventory, if they don't have it, we're fine. Now, there's a page in your deck, Mark, that I thought was very good having gone to law school, but I want other people to understand. It's called the fourth pillar, sui generis. What do you mean?
Yeah, we mean creating new silhouettes that the world hasn't seen, right? So I think where we're coming from is basically, you know, you can protect technology, you can patent what we call cloud tech, but what you can't really, or what is very hard to patent is design and looks. And so what we're doing is we want to establish new silhouettes, new franchises like the Cloud Nova that the world hasn't seen before. And then On owns these silhouettes. So we're going to bring more of those products to the market. And, you know, we're also very, very happy to very soon, actually in a few days, be launching a new product called the Cloud Tilt together with a pretty famous fashion company. And so this will be another example of a sui generis product.
Well, let's talk about fashion. One of the things that astounds me, and I was talking to Regina Gilgan, my executive producer, and my wife, Lisa Kittley, who has too many pairs in my closet. And Martin, what everyone seems to be coming together with in the, I'd say where you have awareness, is that you are a fashion shoe, not just sports, but worn with nice clothes. Highly unusual. Now, I'm not talking about worn with jeans. I'm talking about worn with dress up. Now, I also think that that's sui generis. I've not seen other brands be able to do that.
Yeah, and this is why we also laid out today that actually the mission that we have is to be the most premium sports brand rooted in sustainability, performance, and design. And those are the ingredients that drive what you are describing. So it's a premium product that goes very well with other products, but it's rooted in performance. And it's really all about having products that are also used for performance. And this is why we are doubling down on the athletes that Mark was just describing. We are significantly increasing our share on running route around the world. But we really love to see the product also being used in a daily environment.
Well, good. I'm glad you mentioned that. I also think that you're part of the firmament. I've got to wrap things up here, Mark, with Cyclon. I think it would be wrong not to talk about Cyclon, a subscription product that I think many of the younger people know that is not about show. It's about real when it comes to ESG.
Yeah, hey, we launched Cyclon because we have a very simple mission. We want to make all our products ready for circularity. And so Cyclon was the first one. It's made out of one material. It comes in a subscription model. And once you've used it, we can basically take it back and recycle it. And so this is a very, very important part of our sustainability strategy. And the other important part is that we're basically getting out of fossil fuels. So we also launched a product that is made out of carbon emissions, or we showcased the first product. You can expect that to come to the broader market as of 2025 as a technology. And those pillars will really allow us to, you know, execute on what we believe is so important to this world, that we're making the whole industry way more sustainable.
Good. This is not just saying, listen, we like the environment. You're doing something about it. I want to thank Mark Moore, who's the co-CEO, and Martin Hoffman, who is co-CEO and CFO of On Holdings. Gentlemen, it's really great when you come on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
So Kevin. Happy.
Thank you. Thank you. Mad Money is back after the break.
Coming up, spinning and winning? Are these companies worth more apart than together? Cramer makes the pieces fit. Next.
When you're hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging to connect with candidates faster. Plus, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mad Money. Just go to Indeed.com/Mad Money right now and support this show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mad Money. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
On Monday, we got not one, but two long-awaited breakups. Danaher, the life science and diagnostics titan, spun off its environmental and applied solutions division as Veralto, while Kellogg split into W.K. Kellogg for the North American cereal business and Kellanova for its growth-oriented snack food business. Now, none of them has gotten much love here, thanks to the miserable tape. Hey, that could be changing, right? I think it's worth taking some time right now, though, to go over these post-breakup companies, because both moves could unlock a ton of value for shareholders, particularly if the tape gets better. Tonight, we'll start with the Danaher spinoff, and later this week, we'll cover Kellogg. Now, Danaher is a stock we bought for the Chapel Trust early last year, and I think it's a pretty straightforward story. This is a company that spent many years unloading side businesses to focus on its fast-growing life sciences and diagnostics divisions. But they still had some unrelated legacy operations, like their environmental and applied solutions division. These things just don't really belong under the same roof, so Danaher spun off Veralto to create two pure plays. The idea here is that the new Danaher will get a higher priced earnings multiple, more about that later in the show, as a life science and diagnostic pure play, because it'll have faster growth and higher margins now that Veralto's gone. Meanwhile, maybe Veralto will get more appreciation as a standalone company, because nobody really cared about it as a small division within Danaher. This is a business that's all about water quality testing and product identifiers. And hey, Veralto is good at what it does. They're essentially essential to municipal water suppliers, including right here in New York City, which has some of the best tap water in America. You know, I never understand why restaurant patrons ask for expensive flat bottled water in New York. We got the best water there is in the country. Veralto's technology helps us disinfect up to 2 billion gallons of water every day. When you dig into the financials, there's also a whole lot to like here. For those of you who don't remember, Danaher spent decades acquiring businesses and then making them more efficient. They were the best at this in the world. But then conglomerates went out of style in the Wall Street fashion show, so they decided to become more focused. And businesses like Veralto, they just no longer fit in. However, this newly spun-off company has spent 20 years benefiting from Danaher's excellent management. Roughly 57% of Veralto's total revenue comes from recurring sales, which is not quite as high as the old Danaher 75% recurring revenue rate before the spinoff, let alone the new Danaher, but it's still pretty impressive. And the business isn't particularly capital intensive, so Veralto is consistently able to convert 100% of its net income to free cash flow, very strong. Going forward, Veralto expects to retain a modified version of the old Danaher strategy, which is not only focused on constant self-improvement, but also strategic mergers and acquisitions. Basically, as a standalone company, they can take their cash and use it to roll up the water quality and product identification spaces, of which there are many small acquisitions to make. At its Investor Day event last month, Veralto's management said they'll have greater flexibility to use their cash to make smart acquisitions. They no longer need to ask permission from their old parent company, something they weren't going to get within Danaher, because Danaher wants to be a life science play. They don't want to double down areas that aren't growing that fast. As for the remaining slim down Danaher, I won't go as deep here, because this is a stock I've recommended for years. Although it's been a real dog of late, we'll talk about that next week when we do our Investing Club conference. Danaher is a supplier of everything from big ticket items to common consumables for life sciences industry customers. And they also offer all sorts of services. But the key point to understand is that Danaher is now a pure play on life sciences and diagnostics. Without the Veralto business, their overall growth rate should improve. In fact, it'll get even more of a boost when Danaher completes its $5.7 billion acquisition of a company called Abcam. That's a British life sciences company focused on antibody treatments. Now, those of you who followed Danaher for a while know that the past couple years have been real rough. This stock set an all-time high way back in September 2021. It's basically been drifting lower ever since. A lot of that's because Danaher's diagnostic business made a fortune from COVID testing, not to mention all the pharma and biotech equipment they sold for vaccine development. That's why the stock went from a split-adjusted price in the 130s at the end of 2019 to its all-time high of $296 and change in September 2021. But like all the other COVID winners, there was a post-pandemic hangover as Danaher lapped those high numbers and then customer inventory levels became elevated because so many orders had pushed forward. In response, the stock got clobbered. Don't we know it for the trust? It's been difficult to own. More recently, Danaher's had another problem, the dead IPO market. Why does this matter? Okay, well, when you make life science equipment, many of your customers are smaller biotech companies, and this is an industry that can't really operate unless it's able to raise money. Normally, these small biotechs can raise cash by coming public, which they then spend buying equipment and consumables from alphas like Danaher. Even the private funding markets have dried up over the last couple of years, though, because most venture capital funds have been beaten into being a lot more cautious. Long story short, early stage biotechs have a very hard time raising money. And that means Danaher lost an important group of customers for about a year and a half. Now, here's the good news. It looks like things are finally getting better. Danaher's last quarter delivered in July was fine, although the guidance of the third quarter was a little guarded. I take it talking about a slow single-digit core revenue shrinkage. Boys, that's not that good for the Danaher that I know. And they even cut the full-year forecast, which is really not the Danaher I know. But you know what? Danaher actually rallied in response, which is often a sign that the bottom's been put in. There's now a sense that the industry-wide glut of bioprocessing equipment might actually be worked off. Management stopped short of explicitly saying so on its July conference call, but they did say that their team's closely working with customers to normalize inventories as quickly as possible. And they've intensified those efforts in order to get that process done by year end. Inventory's bad for these guys. They're getting rid of it. Once the bioprocessing market bottoms, I'm confident Danaher can get over its post-COVID hangover. At the same time, the IPO market's coming back to life, meaning that maybe their smaller biotech customers can raise capital again. So what should you do with Danaher and Veralto shares? Look, we're holding on to both shares, stocks for the Chapel Trust right now. Veralto's currently trading at $77 and change, but if you look at Xylem as a comparison for the water business and Zebra Technologies for the product ID business, then Veralto could easily be worth $90 per share, $13 above where it is. Doesn't hurt that this one has much better margins than either of those comparisons, and I would actually argue is much better run. So we're talking about the potential for something like a 16% upside here. That's worth holding on to. As for Danaher, we're sticking with it for the long haul. especially now that the stock's been hit hard since the beginning of September. It has come down from nearly $240 to $216 right here. I think it's a steal. Jeff Marks and I, my partner in crime for the Travel Trust, we both talked about maybe buying some Danaher today. I think it makes a lot of sense. Here's the bottom line. I think this Danaher-Veralto situation is a textbook example of the kind of breakup that can create a ton of value for shareholders, something that we really like and constantly talk about in the club. These are two high-quality companies that didn't belong under the same roof, and sooner or later, I think they'll get higher valuations on their own, especially once Danaher's bioprocessing business finishes bottoming. And we know from speaking with Hologic just the other day, it's in a similar business, they were very close to it, and Thermo Fisher, TMO, says the same thing to me. So I think that Danaher's time is at hand. Let's go to Eddie in Arizona. Eddie.
Booyah, Jim from Phoenix. How are you?
I am good. How about you? How's those Cardinals doing? Kind of early for them. It's early. Cardinals, early.
We'll see. We'll see.
Very early.
Hey, before I ask my question, I just want to thank you so much for everything you and your team do. I'm 36 now, but I grew up watching you with my mom back on the Pablo and Kramer days. And Matt Money.
No, that's great. Eddie, that means a lot to me because I felt if we get people young, they could be with us for the rest of your life. That's exactly what a Colgate wants to do. That's what a Clorox wants to do. So we're doing it right with this, not consumer packaged good, but financial information. How can I help you?
Yeah. Well, my question for you today is about XPO. Well, more about the spinoffs. So I own XPO, one lot of XPO. It's now risk-free. I took my cost basis out. I'm a charter club member, so I took the lessons from you, removed my basis. And now I've got RXO and GXO, and I don't know as much about them, and I feel like they're probably great companies, but it's just more homework and more research on my end and more things
to
keep track of.
You know, it's funny you say that because I felt the same way. I said, wow, RXO, the GXO is logistics. It's pretty good. Look, they're both good. You took your cost bases out. I think you can let them run. I think they're both really good companies, and thank you for those kind words. It means a lot to me. All right, guys, I think Danaher and Veralto are two high-quality companies that are better off on their own. And I think both will be rewarded with higher valuations now that they're not under the same roof. I think we should be thinking about buying more Danaher right here ahead of my club meeting next week. Now, much more Mad Money ahead, including my exclusive with Molson Coors. This is an interesting stock. After announcing some new growth targets and $2 billion worth of share repurchases at its same strategy day, I'm digging the analysis with the company's top brass. I like so far what I've seen, though. And how do you value stocks in a volatile market like this one? I'm revealing an important algebra lesson that subscribers to the CNBC Investing Club know all too well. And all your calls rapid fire in tonight's edition of the Lightning Round. So stay with Kramer. This has been a crazy year for the alcohol industry, especially the light beer space, where the previous kingpin, Bud Light, made some marketing missteps that opened the door for its competitors. One of its biggest winners has been Molson Coors. But unbeknownst to so many, this one's been winning for several years now because of very savvy CEO, Gavin Hattersley, who just had a terrific analyst day laying out what's been accomplished and what can be accomplished still. We are fortunate enough to have Mr. Hattersley with us to talk about the strategy and what he sees happening in Molson Coors and the industry in general. Gavin, welcome back to Mad Money.
Thanks very much for having me, Jim. It's great to be back.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here. Now, Gavin, I think that there was a sense by people that, wow, you've really taken advantage of a current fracas in the beer market. But the fact is, you have been growing numbers for several years now. This strategy meeting, I think, pointed the way. What is fueling the turn that did not start this spring, but it's been going on for several years?
You're 100% right, Jim. I mean, we started our revitalization plan about 3.5 years ago, and we've laid the building blocks to make our organization ready to grow. We're built for growth. We actually are growing, as you rightly call out, and we've laid out our plans to grow into the future for 2, 3, 4 years' time. And, you know, last time you had me on the show, Jim, you predicted that, and you were right.
Well, look, I had to. I like premiumization. You were back in that. And I also know, because you have a finance background, you decided to get that balance sheet right. Those are the two things I love to see. Talk about them, because you accomplished them in a very short period of time.
We did. I mean, 4 years ago when this team came together, I think our leverage ratio was close to 5 times. Yes. And we got it down to just below 2.5 times at the end of June. And we've laid out our algorithm to keep it below 2.5 times. But at the same time, Jim, we announced a $2 billion share buyback program, which will go into place immediately.
Well, I think people should know it's your company is like $13 billion. I mean, that's an actual, you're buying a ton of stock back from what's publicly traded.
Yes, yes, we are. We're going to do that over 5 years, Jim.
Well, I think it's fantastic. Now, I do have to ask you, I read a Gallup poll. Younger people apparently aren't drinking as much as they used to. Do you see that? And also these GLP-1 drugs apparently making it so people don't want to drink as much. Have you seen any impact from the change in habit or the change in medicine?
Jim, you know, from a GLP-1 point of view, no, we haven't seen anything. And I think there's a lot out there that's still unknown, right? I mean, it's an expensive thing to get to a path to go down, right? It's more than $1,000 a month. But what it does do is it does play into this whole health and wellness drive that increasingly consumers are moving along, particularly 21 to 27-year-olds. And that plays right into our overall strategy, where we're moving beyond beer, we're moving into non-alc products, whether those are energy drinks, whether they're non-alcoholic beers. In fact, one of our bigger innovations, which I think is going to be a big deal for us, is the launch of Blue Moon non-alc, which we're bringing in December, just in time for dry January. And I think that's going to play right into that place, space.
Gavin, I'm so glad you brought that up, because you and I both know, because I have some background in the liquor business, I am shocked at how, after many years of people not liking these non-alcoholic beers, which I have to say I always thought tasted awful, they now taste good. And I think that you were the one who told me this could happen. I always said there's no way those beers would taste good. But you have seen it, and people like them.
They do, Jim, and you're absolutely right. If it tastes good, the consumers are going to drink them. And I think our brewers have done an amazing job getting, you know, Blue Moon non-alc to taste very, very similar to Blue Moon Belgian White. And sampled it at the Investor Day yesterday, and they loved it. So I'm looking forward to getting that in the market in December.
You and me both. All right, so the so-called browns and the clears, the vodkas, the gins, you've been in some of the browns. Are they tapering off? I know beer's still growing, but are the actual hard spirits not growing that much?
No, they're growing as well, Jim. They're still increasing share of the alcohol space, and certainly our acquisition of Blue Run Spirits Company is playing right into that trend. And it's an above-premium product, really high margins. It's a great product. It's got a great team that's working behind that acquisition, and we're very excited about it.
Okay, how about at the store level? I know a lot of people drink at a bar, but how are you taking? Are you taking shelf space in the last, say, year or two from other beers?
We're taking a ton of shelf space, Jim. That was one of the big points we landed yesterday. You know, these trend changes that we're seeing and have seen now for 6 months, I know there have been a lot of question marks around whether that's going to stick. Well, I can tell you it is sticking. We've now got 6 months of data to show that those trends are not changing. We're gaining a ton of shelf space in the fall resets, which is very unusual. That doesn't normally happen. And we're expecting to take a lot more in spring. So not only are we getting thousands and thousands of new tap handles, we're getting tens of thousands of extra square footage of retail. And that is what... Is one of the big underpinners for us as we head into next year to drive the continued momentum.
I've always felt that when you take shelf space, it may be glacial when you take it, but it's incredibly sticky once you've got it. It is highly unlikely it'll be rolled back, and more likely that you'll be gaining more space, wouldn't you say, sir?
I completely agree with you, Jim. Once you've got it and your brands are as healthy as our brands are, like Miller Lite and Coors Light, it sticks.
All right, you've been doing some personalization. I happen to be a Flyers fan. I've got in my refrigerator all these Flyers buds, Labatsa. You seem to be making good stuff where the labels matter, I think. Just you and me?
We do.
Tell me about it. Tell me what people like to drink.
No, I think the consumer loves it, Jim. They love seeing their favorite football team or their favorite ice hockey team or baseball team showing up on the packaging, the secondary packaging of their beers. And we do that extensively with Miller Lite in particular. And we're also introducing it to Coors Light next year.
Now, I've been remiss if I didn't talk about the fact that you're really an international brand. I'm focused on America. But if I were to go over to Europe, would I not see your brand be the number one in almost every country?
Yes, you would. Number one or number two, Jim. So if you were in Croatia, you'd be drinking Ožujsko. That's our brand. If you were in the United Kingdom, you'd be drinking Carling, you'd be drinking Coors, you could find Blue Moon. And you'd also find probably the best innovation we've ever had in Europe, which is Madri. We launched that brand 3 years ago, and it is already one of our largest brands in our portfolio. It's a machine.
Don't these travel? I mean, I would like to see some of these. I mean, look, you and I talked about how much we like European drinks. I mean, I used to drink, my father used to drink Carling. This is great beers. Bring them back.
Well, we've got Peroni here right for you now, Jim. That's a great European beer.
It's delicious.
But yes, Madri is a winner, and I'm sure you'll see it at some point in time in the future.
All right, you and I'll knock back one. That's Gavin Hattersley's presidency of Molson Coors Beverages. Had a remarkable turn, not in 6 months, but in multiple years. Thank you, sir. Great to see you.
Thanks, Jim.
All right, Mad Money's back after the break. And then the lightning round is over. Are you ready, Ski Dad? The lightning round comes money. I will start with Sud here in Texas. Sud here.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
I am good. How about you, sir?
I am good, too. Stock to discuss is Upstart Holding, ticker symbol UPST.
Yeah, you know, it's a little too risky for me. It's losing money. I have not liked it. I don't like the stocks that are like kind of these faux banks where there's too much risk. Let's go to Zach in New York. Zach.
Hey, Jim. Booyah.
Booyah to you.
No. So I want to ask your opinion on a stock.
Okay.
Name is Altria Group. Ticker is MO.
Yeah, I'm not going to recommend. I'm today, you know what? I'm too old, and I've seen too much destruction in my own life for tobacco for me to recommend a tobacco stock, including people in my family. So I'm going to take a hard pass on that one. Let's go to Kyle in Wisconsin. Kyle.
Hey, Jim Cramer. You know I like ya.
I didn't know until just now.
You know why? Because you're a guy with some gut. Booyah.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm a retail investor holding quite a few of the SoFi $8 call options, which expired 3 days after their earnings date. I bought the contract at $47 a piece when the stock was at its lowest in June.
Okay.
Fill your guts, Jim. Tell us what you know.
Well, look, I'm not a big buy call ahead of quarter guy because that was the old days, but I will tell you this. I think that Anthony Noto is doing a fabulous job. I also voted for his son for Athlete of the Week, by the way. I went in there. You can go to my Twitter page. But here's what I see. I see that the company is had a really huge move and then had a big pullback. But I think that Noto is a steady hand. So I'm in favor of owning a stock but not trading the stock. How about we go to Bree in Massachusetts? Bree.
Hey, how are you?
I'm okay. How about you?
I'm doing well. You know, markets are tough, but...
It has
I had a quick
tough.
Question for you.
Sure. I'm available.
So I know that you spoke about NEP earlier in the week and the fact that it revised its dividend. NEE, NextEra Energy, has dropped significantly this week.
They've crushed this thing. I got to tell you, I heard an analyst today talk negatively about it down here at 50, but it only yields 3.6. So I got to tell you, I'm still not sold on it. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the conclusion of the Lightning Round.
The Lightning Round is sponsored by Charles Schwab.
How do we value stocks in this terrifying whipsaw market? At the CNBC Investing Club, we call it solving for M, with M meaning the price-to-earnings multiple, what the market's willing to pay for a company's future earnings. Don't freak out about this, please. It's just a bit of algebra. You all took it. If you want to know where a stock's headed, you need to figure out how much a company can first earn per share in the future. That's the E. And what Wall Street is willing to pay for those earnings. That's the M. E times M equals the price of a stock. Jeff Marks and I are constantly trying to figure out the M, mentioned all the time on the network is the multiple, before we buy anything for the travel trust because it helps compute a price target for you. So let me give you an example. Let's say you got a stock. It's, okay, an airline. It looks like it can earn $6 per share, okay, for next year. First, ask yourself how much confidence do you have in that number? How much pressure will the bond market put on it? A subjective figure based on the direction of the 30-year Treasury yield. Remember, stocks are what is known as long-dated assets, and they compete with bonds. Higher bond yields make their stocks' future earnings less enticing. All this factors into how much people are willing to pay for Delta in the future. In the out years. In a calm bond market with travel booming and tame oil prices, it'd be a no-brainer to buy an airline stock at, say, 10 times earnings, roughly half the current multiple in the entire S&P 500. Right now, the S&P is selling for 19 times earnings. At this very moment, though, the airlines are getting pummeled along with the whole transportation index. Fuel costs are high, even after the big breakdown in oil today. Same goes for the yield on 30-year Treasury. So I don't want to pay 10 times earnings for Delta like I normally would. Hey, why don't we do this? Why don't we just slash it to 5 times earnings? Now you multiply the forward earnings estimate 6 by 5, the multiple, and you get 30. Down 6 from where it's currently trading, meaning Delta stock is likely headed lower based on this price to earnings or P.E. analysis. Here's another example. Last night we had Macy's on the show. Right now, the analysts who cover Macy's on average think you can earn a little less than $3. This is an $11 stock, meaning that it sells for less than 4 times earnings, one of the lowest in the entire market, staggering low. Remember, the average stock in the S&P 500, as we just mentioned, is 19 times earnings. Now, since the stock of Macy's, it's insanely cheap, does it deserve that? No way. When you see a price to earnings multiple that's low, only 1/5 the S&P 500's multiple, it is, though, a vote of no confidence. It says money managers are all betting Macy's can't make the numbers. It'll have a weak Christmas. It won't be able to refinance its considerable debt load because rates keep going higher. And things are only going to get worse for its customer base. Many use the Macy's credit card. The market's saying that there'll be credit card big defaults inevitable when you see the yield in the 30-year keep soaring and consumers tightening their belts. That's why the price to earnings multiple is so low. The multiple says a lot, and it is very worrisome for Macy's. But let's say the outgoing CEO, Jeff Gennett, and his replacement, Tony Spring, that we had on the other night are right, that it's a good holiday season. Let's say they mix it up and have more Bloomingdale's and more well-off shoppers, people cottoning up to Blue Mercury, their high-end cosmetics line. Let's say tourism comes back, vital for the Big Herald Square store in Manhattan, and there aren't too many credit card defaults. Then Macy's can make the estimates. And if they actually hit those numbers, the stock will get a much, much higher multiple. So if you have more confidence in those earnings estimates, why not give Macy's the same multiple that you were willing to give the much more volatile airlines? Let's say you pay 5 times earnings for this one. Well, then you'd have a $15 stock, 3 times 5, up from 11 and change right now. Now, let's go back to what we said in the investing club if we wanted to buy Macy's for my charitable trust. We'd say the market's paying too little. That, again, is the M for those earnings estimates. Estimates we feel good about, so the stock's too cheap. We trust management. We think it's a buy because it should rally 4 points from here once they make the numbers. And this is how you solve the valuation equation, and you can do it too at home. After all, it is just 8th grade algebra. Dust off that part of your brain and you'll know what to pay for a stock. It is that straightforward. As long as you factor in all those variables, the variables we talk about every day in the club and right here on Mad Money. I like to say there's always a bull market somewhere, and I promise you I'll find it just for you right here on Mad Money. I'm Jim Cramer. See you tomorrow. Last call starts now.
All opinions expressed by Jim Cramer on this podcast are solely Cramer's opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, or their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by Cramer on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Jim Cramer as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. Cramer's opinions are based upon information he considers reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Mad Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Mad Money disclaimer.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.